Hello and welcome back to Braincast. Today we're fortunate to be joined by Dr. Jacques Ojac, a clinician working on human brain temperature and neurocircadian rhythms, previously at the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, and is now working with AstraZeneca. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Sugi. I'm really, really pleased to be here.
So how did you first get interested in the field of neuroscience and neurobiology? And did you follow this interest through your degree or at university?
It's quite long and complicated. So strap in. I'm going to go right back to the start, which is a very, very long time ago. I think the seed was sown during school work experience. And for me, that was in the late 90s, which seems like eons ago. But it was also a really fascinating time for brain research because we were in the middle of the BSE crisis. And I was incredibly lucky that my best mate's parents happened to be scientists. And so I got to spend those weeks in a government neuropathology lab. And I loved that so much that I kept going back in the holidays. I can't talk in any detail about the work, but needless to say, I was instantly hooked by the brain and these progressive neurodegenerative disorders that we had no cures for. And very naively, I thought if I could understand how the brain works, I could understand how to fix it. And that's really been the thread throughout my clinical academic training and my career ever since. The brain is obviously not an island, and I wanted to explore how it worked with other body systems. So my first degree was in physiology, and that was at Edinburgh. This was an amazing course embedded within a really vibrant neuroscience community. And in the final year, I think there were more than 30 different modules to choose from, but I found myself naturally drawn to things like molecular neurodegeneration and brain plasticity. So that brain obsession hadn't gone away. At the same time, I had my sights set on veterinary medicine. So I was spending my vacations getting work experience at Edinburgh Vet School. And this was mainly with equine experts working on respiratory disease and this really intriguing disorder called equine grass sickness. Now, this is a selective degeneration of the autonomic nervous system, which sadly has a really tragic outcome in many cases. But at the biochemical and molecular level, there are overlaps between this disorder and human neurodegenerative disorders, but we just don't fully understand what causes this disease. Like any student, I was quite keen to explore more of the world, and the cheapest way to do that was to apply for research grants to get me there. And so I took a really active role in the university's expedition society, and kind of by accident, I got roped into this massive medical research expedition to high altitude, where I got to lead a team and collect sleep data at 5,200 meters in the Bolivian Andes. And that opportunity with the charity APEX was really transformative. It was my first taste of leadership. I saw firsthand how to do clinical research in the field and all the contingency planning and processes that make it work. And I'm glad to say that more than 20 years later, I'm still supervising undergraduates to lead their own research projects on these expeditions. And it's kind of my favorite hobby right now. So after my physiology degree, I moved to Cambridge for a second undergraduate in veterinary medicine. And that choice was partly pragmatic because doing the veterinary course anywhere else as a postgraduate would have been financially impossible for me. But I was also really excited about learning in the preclinical years alongside natural scientists and medics and the small group supervisions and also the college system, which means you share these experiences with students studying totally different things, you know, humanities, social sciences and all the rest. At the end of my vet degree, I went into primary general practice with small animals. That was based in Warwickshire. Really enjoyed that fabulous team that I worked with. But again, I was always most interested in the patients that had neurological problems and had a frustration because clinically, just as in human neurology, we don't have many good treatments for a lot of neurological problems in companion animals as well. So at the time I applied for a welcome fellowship, I was very lucky to get that. And this gave me essentially 6 to 7 years of funding to do both a PhD and also specialty training. So I did my PhD in the Chandran Lab back at Edinburgh University. And this was really working on human in vitro models of neurodegeneration. And then I went on to complete my specialty training in veterinary neurology and neurosurgery out at the vet school in Easterbush near Roslyn. And brilliant experience, really understanding and learning about how different neurological diseases present in different species, and learning about all brains of all shapes and sizes, I think gives you a really diverse oversight of how the brain works and when it goes wrong. But again, I still had that frustration of, you know, there were some disorders that we could treat quite well or manage the symptoms of, but for many of those really tricky chronic degenerative problems, there were no effective treatments. We really didn't understand the pathogenesis. And so that's what drove me back to the lab again, back to the bench. And I applied for an MRC, Clinician Scientist Fellowship, very lucky as well to get that. And that took me to the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, where I've pretty much been working on human brain temperature and neural circadian rhythms ever since. And then just in this last year, I've been seconded to AstraZeneca Neuroscience, seeing how we translate discovery into new drugs, new treatments, and clinical trials for patients with neurological problems. So I've kind of seen and had a taste of the whole spectrum, from the very basic and fundamental and molecular, all the way through to in vitro and in vivo modeling, advanced neuroimaging, and all the way through to clinical trials. I'm really, really honoured and privileged that I've been able to have that broad experience. And I think it's shaped how I plan to do research in the future.
That's really interesting that these early experiences within your academic journey have shaped the way that you approach research now. Could you tell us about some of your initial research work, specifically through your PhD?
What I started working on was the protein tau, which you probably will have heard about in the context of Alzheimer's disease and other tauopathies. So this protein is very important for microtubule structure and neuronal structure in the brain. It has many other functions as well, but that's the one that it's most famous for. And in a disease context, what we understand about this protein is that it's a very disordered dynamic protein, but it becomes quite ordered and changes conformation. And then that leads to these buildup of insoluble aggregates of tau protein within neurons within the brain in a wide variety of disorders, actually, but most frequently talked about is Alzheimer's disease and frontotemporal dementia. So I was interested in that protein from wanting to understand how it caused disease and trying to discover new treatments for that, which is why I was based in the Chandran lab. And the Chandran lab was an amazing lab to do a PhD in, because it was quite large, but there were basic scientists, there were clinicians, all working towards this common goal of trying to understand what causes neurodegeneration in the first place. Not just thinking about the neurons, but also thinking about the other cell types in the brain as well, and essentially modeling a lot of these different diseases in a dish. So motor neuron disease, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, and tauopathies. I started on this road of wanting to look at mutations in the tau protein, which we know cause genetic forms of frontotemporal dementia. Those are actually very rare. In the vast majority of neurodegenerative disorders that include tau pathology, the tau protein itself is what we call wild type. It is not mutant in any way. It's the normal form of the protein. It's just that over time, things change and it starts to behave differently. And we don't really have a great understanding of why that happens. This is still the case, even 100 years after Alois Alzheimer first discovered these tangles within the human brain. We still don't have a really good handle on why the wild type version of the protein forms these aggregates. So it was definitely an accident, I think. I came across a really interesting paper from Thomas Arendt's lab in Leipzig, who was looking at wild type tau protein, but in the brains of hibernating ground squirrels. And with my sort of vetty hat on, this immediately, you know, pricked my ears. I was immediately attracted to this paper, and I started looking through this paper and realized that when you were looking at changes in tau protein in the hibernating brain, it was changing in many of the similar ways that you would see in an Alzheimer's disease brain. It was becoming hyperphosphorylated, and it was happening in the parts of the brain that you would expect in Alzheimer's disease. And I thought to myself, well, here's a brain that is doing this, but it's doing it reversibly, and it is a completely normal part of the physiology of this animal. And as we understand hibernation, it's a critical aspect of the survival of that species, especially when resources are rare. And one beautiful observation from those studies was that when the brain goes into hibernation in these animals, there is deafferentation, so that the connections between the brain cells are actually physically, structurally coming apart. And then when these animals are coming out of hibernation, those connections are faithfully rejoining again. And this, to me, was mind-blowing. This idea that maybe a protective aspect of this process was the fact that these connections were being broken effectively and then just magically coming back together again. And these animals were, to all intents and purposes, not known to have any cognitive problems or memory issues upon arousal, could still go and find the food that they'd tucked away somewhere to save for later. So there was this fascinating idea around this protein tau perhaps being very important in neuronal plasticity. We already knew that in terms of neurodevelopment, but these brains were adult brains. These were not, you know, neonatal brains, and being important in the plasticity of neuroprotection, because the idea being that hibernation is protective or neuroprotective for the brain. That got me off onto a slight tangent, as you can imagine, compared to many of the other people in the lab. And on the one hand, it was a little bit isolating because I was doing something and working on something completely different to everybody else. But on the other hand, it was also quite liberating. And I'm very grateful to my supervisor, who had the faith and the confidence in me to just drive this forward and do something a little bit out of the box. And I think really that's kind of been the flavor of how I do research. I'm always doing something just that little bit different to what people might expect, because for me, that's where the exciting stuff happens. I was using human cortical neurons that have been grown from stem cells. At the time, that was actually a very cutting edge technique. It's now far more commonplace and used by many, many labs across the globe. But we were effectively differentiating human stem cells into brain cells in the lab. And my first immediate experiment that I wanted to do was look at what happens to tau protein in these neurons when you change the temperature. What I tried to do was mimic the kind of temperatures that might happen clinically. For decades, cooling has been thought of as a neuroprotective treatment. There are actually only very few patients in which there's really good evidence that this works well, but there were, you know, there's moderate hypothermia, which takes the core body temperature down to somewhere between 32 and 35 degrees Celsius. And then right at the bottom of the sort of survivable scale is the suspended animation level, which is around about 28 degrees Celsius. So I was essentially taking a very crude, but potentially very effective treatment from the clinic and trying to figure out how that worked at the molecular level in a dish. And that's what I did. And in the process, what I found was, at the same time as you get these very predictable changes in tau protein, you also get upregulation of a small number of proteins that respond to cold. And these are these cold shock RNA binding proteins. And what it appeared to be, at least in my hands, was that although it was correlative, that these changes in tau protein were actually part of a neuroprotective response. So whereas we might think of those changes being a bad thing in the context of insoluble aggregates and Alzheimer's disease, in real time, in a dish, in the lab, it seemed that they were part of this neuroprotective response, because those cells that were cooled down were far better able to deal with more toxic insults. And out of that was born this concept of hypothermic preconditioning, not invented by me at all, but certainly something that's been described in other systems. What I was trying to say was that I think that's what was going on with these cells in a dish. And it was happening possibly, and some of the other experiments I was working with suggested that this could be happening because these post-translational modifications in this tau protein, like hyperphosphorylation, almost creates a minor stress for the protein quality control pathways in the cell. It ramps up its protein quality control systems, and then it becomes better able to deal with far more toxic insults, far harder insults like oxidative stress and excitotoxic chemicals. So it seemed like training the internal protein quality control systems in these brain cells by using a mild stress like hypothermia could make them better able to deal with much more difficult stresses later on. That's why the work was really framed around hypothermic preconditioning. But I think it's important to stress that these were brain cells, cortical neurons in a dish, in a completely artificial environment, not in a brain. And whether those same processes are really happening in the human brain when it's cooled down, we don't know. A really important caveat and limitation of that work was this core assumption that I had made, and many other people also would make, that the brain is normally 37 degrees, and it's 37 degrees all the time, and it's 37 degrees all over. But by the end of my PhD, and I had sifted through decades of literature trying to find the primary evidence of what normal human brain temperature was, and it just wasn't there. And so I was left at the end of my PhD with, on the one hand, feeling like I'd found something really interesting, and on the other hand, thinking, but maybe all of this is nonsense because my control condition was 37 degrees and maybe that's not the normal temperature of the human brain. And then, of course, this led to the later work that I started doing as a postdoc at the LMB.
So you've looked into animal studies with the hibernation of ground squirrels and also tested with cortical neurons in vitro, but how far do you think you can generalize the findings of these studies to a real human brain?
I think it's a really important question. And essentially, it's that very question that drove me to doing work to really answer the problem of what is normal human brain temperature, because we didn't know. For me, that was the natural next step. Okay, we think we've seen this finding, but what is the normal temperature of the human brain? How much does it vary? Would it even vary enough on a daily basis to affect these changes that we're seeing in tau protein in a dish? In vitro work is becoming more and more widely used for good reason. We understand that there are many important species differences. And so really trying to model disease in a human context is very important, primarily for NC3Rs, reduction, replacement and refinement in terms of the use of animals in research, but also really trying to model what's going on in the human brain. Those systems are becoming more complex. So we have biculture and triculture systems where we're not just necessarily culturing one cell type. You can start adding in other different cell types that are found in the brain and we know are really important to how the brain works. And then we go up all the way to these more complex 3D models like cerebral organoids, which I've started working with more recently. But still, these are not whole brains in a dish. These are not an exact replica of what's going on in real life. And I think it's very important that we keep that in mind. But yes, these systems can really give us far more traction on being able to manipulate things and test things in a human context that we simply couldn't do in a human in the real world, because there would be obvious ethical difficulties with doing that.
So to go back a bit, during your PhD, you had this assumption that normal human brain temperature is 37 degrees, but what do you say it is now? And have you explored that experimentally?
The problem we've had over many years is that you can't stick a thermometer into a healthy brain because that wouldn't be appropriate. We do get direct brain temperature measurements from patients with traumatic brain injury and the ones that end up with having an intracranial probe placed. But historically, those probes are there really to measure things like oxygen tension and intracranial pressure. And very often, they're not really measuring temperature. Even though we know temperature is very important for brain function, those probes often either don't measure temperature, or when they are measuring temperature, the temperature is being used to calibrate the oxygen sensor. It's not really being measured for its own sake. I was very lucky to collaborate with Dr. Jonathan Rhodes, who's a specialist in anaesthesia and critical care medicine at NHS Lothian. And he'd been collecting these data from patients for a long time and really waiting for the breathing space and the brain space to do some proper research with these data. And so he had a lot of these temperature data that weren't really being used for much. With him, I did a retrospective analysis of directly measured brain temperature from patients with traumatic brain injury. And we also brought that together with several other collaborators in Europe from the Centre TBI database. And then in a more prospective fashion, what I wanted to do was really look at what healthy brain temperature is doing. And there was a technique called MRS thermometry And there was a team at Edinburgh Imaging, Dr. Michael Thrippleton and Professor Ian Marshall. They'd already used this technique to look at brain temperature, but they hadn't used it to look at brain temperature variation per se. They'd not really done a sort of a comprehensive overview of how temperature might change in time and space. So here I came and said, well, why don't we measure brain temperature, but measure it across the whole day? And why don't we measure it in lots of different places in the brain as well? So there, I really wanted to understand how much human brain temperature varied normally. Here was this study. We wanted it to be prospective. We wanted it to be as inclusive as possible. I wanted to make sure we had equal numbers of males and females. And when you're studying something like temperature, the immediate criticism comes, well, if you include females, then they have menstrual cycles and that could impact the results. And of course, to me, that's just fundamentally really interesting. So absolutely, we were going to include females, and we were definitely interested in whether the stages of the menstrual cycle might impact what temperatures we got from the brain. We controlled for that using urine testing, so we knew which phase of the menstrual cycle our female subjects were in. And we also controlled for something that's very important and close to my heart, which is chronotype. Chronotype is essentially how our internal body clock aligns with the day-night cycle. And you might have heard of morning larks or night owls. I'm an extreme night owl. I naturally, without an alarm clock, would like to wake up at lunchtime and go to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning, which is often not possible. But we understand that there's this variation amongst the general population of chronotypes, which means that at any given fixed external point in time, if I was to collect temperature data from myself, being a night owl, and collect temperature data from somebody else who's a morning lark, we would be at very different phases of our temperature cycle. So we know that body temperature goes up and down on a daily basis. But if you are a very different chronotype to the next person, that rhythmic variation is going to be shifted depending on what sort of chronotype you have. And the problem with that, it's probably only making a small difference, but it just adds a lot of noise to your data set. So what we found was that by controlling for chronotype, we were able to extract a much larger effect size in our data and really test that hypothesis of whether brain temperature varies by time of day or not. And we still would have had significant results without chronotype control, but I do advocate for using chronotype control wherever possible, because I think it really gives you a much better insight into what's really going on with daily physiology. How do we control for that? It's actually quite straightforward to do. We used these wrist-worn actigraphy devices. It's a bit like a research version of a Fitbit. It's collecting round-the-clock data on light exposure, activity, skin temperature, and then you can use software and fancy algorithms to figure out the sleep-wake cycle, when people are going to bed, when they're waking up. And if you're able to capture that across a week, and on at least on maybe two of those days where people can just wake up naturally, you're able to derive this metric, which gives you a pretty accurate prediction of a phase marker for their internal body clock. And then what you can do is use that phase marker, compare it to the time point that they were actually having their brain temperature measured, and then correct for what we call the time distance between these two values. And I probably made that sound quite complicated, but basically what it allows us to do is to control for individual differences in chronotype between our subjects. And it gives us a much cleaner data set and gives us much better insight into what's really happening by time of day. So we did that. We measured brain temperature in all of these people at three times across the day. So they came in for a scan in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the late evening, right before bedtime. And we used those data to build the first four-dimensional map of human brain temperature. And what we found partly made sense and was quite predictable. Some of it was quite surprising. So we expected to see a spatial gradient in temperature across the brain, but it really was quite remarkable, around about 2.5 degrees at any given point in time between the hottest and coolest parts of your brain. I was quite astounded by that. It was more than I was expecting. We also found differences between the sexes, and this did seem to be driven primarily by menstrual cycle phase, because it was really only females in the post-ovulation phase of their menstrual cycle that had a higher body temperature and higher brain temperature as well. We found that there was a diurnal or daily variations. We expected to see a drop in brain temperature towards predicted sleep time, and that's exactly what we saw. But interestingly, that daily variation in brain temperature was happening to a much greater extent in the deepest parts of the brain, the evolutionarily oldest parts of the brain. And that was a really interesting finding. And then finally, something which we really weren't expecting, because we tried to control for age in our data set. So we only scanned healthy adults between the ages of 20 and 40 years. But even within those 20 years, we saw that there was a global increase in mean brain temperature. And that increase was even more in the deepest parts of the brain. So automatically, we're thinking, well, what happens after 40 years? What happens when you're 60, when you're 80? And we just don't know yet. But these are some of the follow-on questions that we'd like to answer moving forward with this research. And in particular, trying to understand how and why brain temperature varies in the way that it does.
Do you believe that maybe neurological disorders and diseases can be related to this concept of brain temperature increasing on average with age?
Yes, in a short answer. To give you a far more complicated answer, one of the main reasons that we know from other species, one of the primary ways in which brain temperature is regulated is through cerebral blood flow. And we do know that there is a diurnal variation in cerebral blood flow in humans as well as other species. Blood flow goes up at night, which makes sense, but the brain temperature is simultaneously going down. Why does that make sense? Because blood flow is the main way by which heat is removed from the brain. This is also seen in cases of stroke, for example, when there's been a blockage to a blood vessel in the brain that's caused a stroke, that local area of the brain will heat up. And there are studies that have used the very technique that we've used and shown that there is an increase in temperature in regions of the brain that have acutely lost a blood supply. So we know that brain blood flow is really important for regulating brain temperature. Whether it explains all of the brain temperature variation we see, we don't know. There may well be a diurnal variation in brain metabolism as well, which we might expect. But what the relative contribution of heat production from metabolism is versus heat loss from cerebral blood flow, we don't know. We have plans to address this very question with some follow-on experiments. In terms of that age effect, we certainly know that our cardiovascular system ages along with us. And there is pretty good evidence now that a lot of neurodegenerative disorders have a component of vascular compromise, whether that's more obvious in cases of vascular dementia or more subtle in other forms of dementia. We do know that the vasculature is really important. We also know there's pretty good evidence that maintaining cardiovascular health is important for reducing the risk of some of these disorders later on in life. So it does very much fit with the idea that maybe there's an increase in temperature from ages 20 to 40, perhaps because our cerebrovascular anatomy is not performing as well as it used to. Now, you could ask, well, what happens after age 40? And of course, we don't know yet. But what we can say from our data is that it looks as though that heating effect is starting to plateau off at around about age 40. So it's not just a straight linear relationship. There does seem to be some plateauing off at the top end, which on the one hand, you might think, oh, that's quite reassuring. Maybe the brain temperature is not going to keep going up. On the other hand, you could be sitting there thinking, well, is that because our blood vessels are suddenly just dealing with everything very well? Or is it actually because we're starting to lose some of that heat producing tissue by the age of 40? So maybe we're not producing as much brain heat as we used to, and therefore maybe brain temperature is not able to climb even further higher as time goes on. Do I think this could be related to neurodegenerative disorders? At the most fundamental level, at the level of the cell, yes, I do, because I've already shown with my PhD work that tau protein, for example, and many of the disorder proteins that are linked to some of these disorders are very temperature sensitive. So if you mess up temperature variation, and particularly I would imagine if you mess up the timing of that temperature variation, you could be creating the biophysical conditions within the cell that allows these cells to aggregate and phosphorylate to an abnormal extent and start seeding some of these abnormal features that we see with pathology post-mortem. I'm really keen on understanding that whole process in real time, in the dynamics of it. And obviously, that's very challenging to do in a normal human brain, but we can start to answer some of these questions in a dish using some of those more complex model systems that I mentioned earlier.
I had the privilege of watching your exhibit, Hot But Not Bothered, a timely temperature shift on the human brain machine at the LMB Open Day last year. And you recently published a paper on circadian clocks in the human cerebral organoids. What can you tell us about your current research into circadian rhythms?
Yes, so circadian rhythms are essentially internal daily rhythms within the cell. They are cell autonomous. We predict that every cell in your body and your brain has this circadian clock, as we like to call it. And it's not so much a timekeeper. So when we use the phrase circadian clock, it's a little bit misleading because we don't think these oscillations within the cell are really keeping time. They're more predicting time. They evolved a long, long time ago. They exist in every kingdom of life. And what we think these internal oscillators are doing is predicting the external environment that would be expected because Earth is rotating on its axis once roughly every 24 hours. And so our molecular and biochemical processes within the cell have evolved to have this rhythmic pattern because they're best optimizing the cell's physiology to this variable 24-hour environment that it's surrounded by. So this is how we think they've evolved as almost predictors, anticipators of the external world. By that very nature, they are imprecise, which means that if I was to take cells from you or anybody else and put them in a dish in the lab, I would be able to find ways of monitoring the daily rhythms of these cells under constant conditions, but they might not necessarily be exactly 24 hours. They're usually either a little bit shorter or a little bit longer. In humans, they're generally a little bit longer than 24 hours. And this imprecision is quite important because it means that that oscillator is flexible and adaptable to a change in the environment. So each day, our internal rhythms are reset by the schedule that we keep. So whether that be the light dark cycle that we're exposed to, when we eat, when we do exercise, all of these external timing cues feed into this clockwork system and they keep it in sync with the external world. There are three main features that define a circadian rhythm. The first is that it should be observable under constant conditions and have a period length of roughly 24 hours. It's very difficult to establish that unless you're doing it under very controlled laboratory conditions, which is why in the real world, when we do experiments like measuring human brain temperature, this is not really a circadian experiment. It's a diurnal or a daily experiment. So that's the first main hallmark feature. The second main hallmark feature is that those rhythms must be responsive to external timing cues, which makes sense because if external conditions change, those clocks then need to reset themselves to the new external time frame. And this is what happens when you fly across to the other side of the world. You experience the symptoms of jet lag for the first few days because your internal biological, physiological circadian rhythms are immediately out of sync with external time. And it takes a few days for things to realign again because your internal clocks are resetting themselves according to these external cues that they're receiving. And roughly speaking, it takes about a day for every hour difference that you move across a time zone. So that's the second feature. They need to respond to external timing cues. That's very important. And the third and final hallmark feature of a circadian rhythm in most systems is that it should be temperature compensated. And what we mean by that is that the period length of the rhythm should not really change across the physiological range of normal temperatures. So if I grow human brain cells at 37 degrees, they should have a period length of roughly 24 hours. If I then grow them at a constant 40 degrees Celsius, they should also have roughly the same period length. So this is really interesting, right? Because a circadian rhythm or a circadian clock is, at the same time, it is responsive to an external cue, which might be a temperature shift. So they definitely reset to temperature changes, but the period length of the cycle should stay the same regardless of what temperature we're exploring them at. So those are the three main features of circadian rhythms. They've been studied really well in mammalian fibroblasts, in cyanobacteria, in the suprachiasmatic nucleus of the rodent brain. So we understand that there is a core oscillator or pacemaker that sits right down in the depths of your brain in the hypothalamus. And it's thought that these suprachiasmatic nuclei are driving and pacing the circadian rhythms in all other cells in the body. So they determine what hormones are released downstream that then reset other rhythms in the body. They help to drive your eating and hunger behavior and also your ability to be active. So it's thought that this central core pacemaker is effectively orchestrating all the other clocks and keeping them in tune with each other, which we think is important for healthy function. But we're still not entirely sure how critical that is in humans. And so there's been lots and lots of work in neurobiology and neuroscience on the suprachiasmatic nucleus in rodents, but far less exploration of other parts of the brain and far less, even more so in humans or in human neural systems. So what I was very keen to do was use human in vitro neural systems that had nothing to do with the suprachiasmatic nucleus, had never seen a suprachiasmatic nucleus, and really try and see whether these circadian rhythms really exist at all in these other brain cells. And if they do, what does that tell us about healthy brain function? Can we manipulate them? Can we reset them? Can this help us understand what's going on in some brain diseases down the line? So that's really what a lot of my in vitro work has been focusing on. And I've been really lucky to partner with BitBio, which is a local biotech company that has a brilliant system for directly differentiating stem cells very quickly into different brain cell types. So I've been able to use that to look at neurons and astrocytes and microglia. And also, one of the best things about being at the LMB is Dr. Lancaster and her wonderful work with cerebral organoids. And so we partnered up and we've been using this system and exploring circadian rhythms using this 3D system. And it's really shone a light on just how much things are varying in human mini brain tissues around the clock under constant conditions.
So your research often intersects with other fields, as you mentioned, like biotech. Do you believe that taking an interdisciplinary approach is important in neuroscience?
Definitely, yes. I mean, right now, I think my research is a mashup of temperature, timekeeping, biophysics, neuroscience, neurology, advanced neuroimaging, engineering, thermodynamics, computer science. I mean, the whole lot, and the pharmaceutical industry. So it's absolutely critical because these disorders are so challenging to tackle that unless we have lots of different ideas and perspectives, all hands to the deck, we're really never going to have a handle on what's causing them. And we're never really going to be able to treat them effectively if we don't do that. So it's absolutely critical. Huge, huge strides have been made in neuroscience over recent decades. But we still don't really understand how the brain works. There's been a lot of investment in the hardware. So really important in understanding the cells and the circuits that perform neural processing and the molecular machines that make that possible. But just as important, in my view, is the environment in which they operate. You wouldn't study the workings of a car at the bottom of the ocean, right? So that's why I'm so fascinated by brain temperature dynamics, because for the first time, we've shown that actually brain temperature isn't constant. It's changing a lot. What on earth does that mean for brain function? And what could that mean for how the brain starts to become dysfunctional over time? And I think now is really the time to bring all of these new tools and technologies to bear, particularly with advances in machine learning and other AI techniques. I think that's going to absolutely transform how we understand dynamism in the brain.
And finally, is there any advice or insight you would give to students who are aspiring to go into this field?
Well, number one, and I would always say this to any student, is respect your sleep. Number two, I think right now, as you've probably been hearing about, I think it's important to upskill in AI tools that can assist you in whatever you choose to do in life, whether that's neuroscience or anything else. But no matter how fancy things get, and they're getting quite fancy quite quickly, don't forget the basics, like mistaking precision for accuracy or mistaking correlation for causation. Because humans can get things wrong, humans can lie, generative AI can hallucinate. The truth really lies in the raw data. So you need to be ready and willing to explain the unexpected and explore those results from different angles, challenge the status quo, listen to different perspectives, and keep asking questions. Because I guess from my work on brain temperature, if I just kept assuming that the brain was 37 degrees, half the stuff I'd done would not have been possible. And that assumption would still be propagated, I think, for many years to come. And this is important for patients now, not just for patients in the future, but it's important right now in terms of how we, you know, measure and monitor temperature in the clinic. And then I think the last thing really is never allow anyone else to determine your fate. If you're truly passionate about something, you should grab every opportunity you can to get involved. You're going to meet smart, ambitious, and generous people in neuroscience. You might also meet people that you don't gel with. This is normal. And no one gets through life without some sort of baggage. But what I would ask is, you know, please don't throw yours at the people who are trying to help you get from A to B and beyond. You will meet some brilliant people. Do your best to work with them, and be patient, because sometimes different skills and different mindsets work in different ways. And some people might pick a certain technique up really, really quickly, and other people might struggle. But, you know, if you share your skills and ideas with other people, you're going to have a much richer experience during your PhD than if you just tuck yourself into a corner and just try and do everything on your own. So one of the most important things, I think, of wanting to move forward.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us today, Nina, and sharing your knowledge. It was a privilege to hear a bit about your fascinating and exciting research.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I was delighted that you came to see the talk on brain temperature. It was brilliant. It was lovely. You probably saw that I was running around in a giant brain outfit.
I did, yeah.
There was a subtle sustainability message in that. So, I made it by stuffing loads of ballet tights with polystyrene balls from old beanbags, and also from all the polystyrene chips that I could gather from around the lab. So you probably know that in most labs, when you get things delivered, It comes in a great big box. And if it's a dry goods, it's normally surrounded by this mass of polystyrene chips, which can't be really used for anything. And they're not biodegradable. So I trawled around the LMB before that talk, gathering up everybody's polystyrene chips and then stuffing them into tights. So I didn't mention sustainability in the talk, but I was trying to reuse polystyrene as best I could. Of course, then I was immediately the most flammable person in the room. So I don't recommend wearing this outfit here at Open Flame. So just don't try that at home.